Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery. If the Pando Aspen put out an ad in the classifieds, it would sound something like this.
Single male with strong roots, looking for fertile ground to plant my seed and grow together.
So far, Pando hasn't had many takers. Pando aspen is a clonal colony of a single male quaking aspen, Populus tremoloides, also known as the trembling giant because of its elliptical leaves that flutter in the breeze. Pando aspen grow in clones or groups of genetically identical trunks, all originating vegetatively, not sexually, from a single ancestor. This colony is located in the Fish Lake National Forest on the western edge of the Colorado Plateau in south-central Utah. And it humbly holds a couple of world records. First, the colony is collectively estimated to weigh about 6,000 tons, making it the largest known organism on the planet. And even though each tree on the surface looks like a separate individual, they are all attached by an intricate root system that stakes claim as the oldest known living organism on Earth. Some estimate from 80,000 years to a million years old. Ron Rael, a Utah State University plant ecologist, or plant ecophysiologist, illustrates the importance and urgency of protecting the Pando clone.
The Pando clone is kind of like a canary in a coal mine. In the last 100 years, it's probably reaching points where it may wink out if we don't do some fairly drastic measures here in the near future. And I think it tells us something about how we've been managing some of our landscapes, not really recognizing some of the risks that we're running. But also it's an awareness that we still have some time to do some very positive things too.
The Pando clone is important on a macro level, not only because of its size, but also because it serves as a gauge that is telling about the overall health and balance of our natural environment. The phenomena of dwindling aspen clones has a name, sudden aspen decline, or SAD. And the decline is very much underway in this famous 108-acre Utah Pando clone, due to a multitude of factors still being determined, but including wildlife management and global warming.
The term Pando is Latin for I spread.
That was Paul Rogers, who was the director of the Western Aspen Alliance.
The entire clone is a real mystery. So you can think about this differently when you walk into a forest. When you see a stem of an aspen, you say that's an aspen tree. But all of its little partners around may be exact clones of it and actually one organism. Would be different than a pine tree, where you see a stem, that's an individual. But an aspen, it could be this massive creature.
The Western Alliance came together to save the aspen.
Well, this Pando clone, for the most part, has one layer. And it's mature and it's dying very fast now. In August, there was a report in a German newspaper about the Pando clone in Utah. In September, there was a report on the BBC Online paper. So this is not a local phenomenon. This is sort of an international icon. The Pando clone is now well known. It's also maybe not known that the Pando clone is on a stamp. So it's a national icon in that way as well. So it has a name. It has a name that's associated with Utah. And it has a name that's really associated with aspen sciences in general.
In fact, it is a commemoration stamp recognizing the Pando clone as one of the 40 wonders of America. Rogers and the Alliance are trying to improve communication among the ecologists who study these trees, forestry managers, and state and federal agencies.
The main focus of this alliance is to facilitate transfer of recent research to land managers. That's really where we're headed. We feel that a lot of folks are dealing with research that's a little bit out of date, but also there's a lot of new issues coming up, and we want to keep people well informed and set up a feedback loop too, so that managers can keep researchers well informed about potential situations.
And Rogers depends on one of them.
There's a scientist here at Utah State University that works on aspen genetics. Her name is Dr. Karen Mock.
The Pando clone is one genetic individual. that consist of many, many individual trees. In fact, the typical state for aspen, especially in the West, in western U.S., is to exist as a collection of many stems representing the same genotype. Sometimes it's a few stems, sometimes it's very, very many. The Pando clone happens to be one that was described even before the advent of these genetic tools, was described morphologically. And I would be surprised if it actually is the largest clone. Okay. No one has done a comprehensive survey looking for large clones. However, we're finding that there's much, much more clonal diversity out there than we'd ever thought before. I mean, it's really taken all of us by surprise. Really? So it's kind of an exciting finding.
Karen Mock is a Utah State University conservation geneticist who uses genetics to find solutions to conserving and restoring biodiversity. Her latest research is exciting because the more diverse the clone, the more evolutionary success it has. And of late, Mock has seen more diversity in the clone. But let's take a step back to really understand what's happening. In Mock's own words, she explains it like this. The Pando clone is a single genetic entity, like one tree with many branches, only the branches are trees. We don't have any evidence that there are fragments of the Pando clone on the landscape. All the trees in the Pando clone come ultimately from the same single tiny seed. It is possible that parts of the Pando have accumulated unique mutations, same as in an individual human where you have occasional mutations that arise in certain cells of the body. There is a remote possibility that some of these mutations could be beneficial, and that those trees or branches would have some kind of advantage. But there's a much bigger chance that they would have either no effect or a negative effect on fitness. That's Pando's Achilles heel. All those trees are stuck in evolutionary time since they are so genetically uniform. If it were a diverse stand of genetically different trees that were reproducing by seed, that group of trees would be able to evolve over time to track changing conditions by making new combinations of genes. However, clones do have their advantages.
It's very clear that aspen reproduces clonally as a strategy, as an ecological strategy. If you lose a single tree, you don't lose the entire clone. That's a real advantage for that genotype, right? Because if it's represented by many, many trees, then it can undergo losses in certain parts of the landscape or in certain parts of the clone, and the clone itself will persist. It really challenges, I think, ideas about individuality. That's why I love working on these kinds of problems. Because, is the tree the individual? Is the clone the individual? How long does it live? So just philosophically, it's a fun thing to work on.
Wow. So an aspen clone can speak to the human condition and even serve as a metaphor for our fear of losing our identity? Humans are typically scared of clones because, as Mock suggests, they threaten or at least profoundly confuse our idea of individuality, a very familiar topic in science fiction novels and film, and now a very controversial subject in science itself. And if we are cloned, are we still alive? This is the same issue researchers are having a hard time with in determining the age of the aspen clones.
What we wish we had for aspen is something called a molecular clock, where you could just simply say this genotype and this one are this far apart. And that distance then would have a linear relationship to time. Unfortunately, that doesn't exist. There have been several recent attempts to do some dating like that, but it's really difficult. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem is that we don't have a known standard. If we had a known age on a particular clone or a series of clones, then we would be able to figure that out. But it's a very difficult problem. And so it's hard to say what kind of ages these represent.
Because the aspen clone is in a continual state of regeneration, thousands of sprouts constantly popping up, the age of the Pando clone is still undetermined.
Oh, they range all over the map. Yeah, the estimates go from, you know, maybe a 1,000 years old to, you know, just based on the rate of clonal spread, to maybe, oh gosh, one person even made an estimate of 1,000,000 years, which, you know, is pretty far out there.
The mystery of the pando clone's true age is a big scientific challenge. Aspen species in general are exceptional in their role in our Western ecosystem.
What makes them unique is sort of a series of things, not just that they clone, because there are lots of clone plants, not just because they're a pretty tree, there are lots of those, but they do tend to be uniquely important in terms of biodiversity, especially in the West. It's one of the main deciduous trees that is present in any density in Western forest. And so the aspen forests tend to support a very broad range of biodiversity. Many bird species depend on aspen, and so that makes it kind of unique.
This is the largest living organism known on Earth, and it is at risk, possibly due to climate change. But Paul Rogers and Karen Mock suggest ungulates, such as deer and elk, who feast on the young stems, are the main threat to these trees right now. To help combat the problem, ecologists and land managers have put fences around aspen colonies to help keep the hungry animals out. Still, it is not enough.
Now, there are threats to aspen, and there's recently been a phenomenon called sudden aspen decline, particularly on the Colorado Plateau, which is the Four Corner region, and in this case, particularly involving southwest Colorado, where folks thought that they were going to be declining very rapidly. I don't think that's the case, but at certain areas, and particularly at lower elevations, south-facing slopes, perhaps related to recent droughts and perhaps related to more long-term climate warming, there's certain to probably be some declines at certain elevations, those what I call marginal stands of aspen that they'll dry up essentially, and it's hard to support them over a long term. Are they declining over the whole region? I don't believe so. There may be just an increase in elevation of aspen if we go into a climate warming cycle, but I don't see that. Where there's more of an issue is at particular locations. Commonly, if we have drought situations, the large mature trees will die off and sprouts will take over, and that's, we feel like that's a pretty good cycle, and that's things die and things are born, and that's sort of how the life cycle of aspen goes along. We've been seeing a real disruption of that cycle on the things being born end, that is the sprouting of aspen. And that quickly gets into the browsing by domestic livestock and wild ungulates. And ungulates are basically hooved animals, predominantly in this situation deer and elk. And in a lot of states in the West, deer populations are going down and elk populations are increasing. And so hence we have sort of a natural conflict between wildlife managers and vegetation or forest managers and forest ecologists. And we just need to sort of figure out a way to come together and work through these issues. And just in short, the wildlife issues quickly get into the realm of social and economic and cultural issues, i.e. hunters love to hunt. And increasingly, though there's fewer hunters, hunters that are hunting now are going after large trophy bull elk. And it takes a lot of female cow elks to support a single bull elk. And all of those elk, increasing populations, can have potentially large impacts on aspen regeneration. So you can see the story is getting more and more complicated as we talk here. Then we get into more conflict when we start talking about things like the big bad wolf.
Bill Ripple, professor of forest resources at Oregon State University in Corvallis, recently presented at the Utah State University Restoring the West Conference and has developed a widely accepted hypothesis and research on why aspens have been disappearing. He is building on the 1940s work of Aldo Leopold, the American ecologist environmentalist, who was one of the first to notice and then investigate the phenomena of the disappearing aspen groves. Leopold was highly scrutinized and reportedly ostracized for his theory on the correlation between top predators, namely wolves, with regards to aspen proliferation in Yellowstone National Park.
We found that the federal government killed off the wolves in the 1920s. So at this point, the light bulbs went off and we started writing and publishing on this theory of called trophic cascades. So that's simply saying that the disappearance of wolves affects their prey, and their prey affects the aspen trees. So the way this works is that wolves prey on elk, and elk like to eat these young shoots that are coming out of the ground, these aspen shoots. So we connected those dots and published that story as a hypothesis, and it was pretty well received. The experiment in Yellowstone continues in that the park decided to bring wolves back in 1995 and reintroduce wolves to the northern part of the park. So here we have a chance to test our theory to see, well, if it's correct, then with wolves back and them preying on elk, and since we think elk are eating the young aspen trees, could it be that with the reintroduction of this predator that aspen will again flourish? Over the last 10 years, we've been studying that response. It's amazing to see, but the aspen are now growing again in places. So it's exciting. Its restoration takes a long time. But we are starting to see aspen grow taller and taller and taller in some places. So before wolves, the aspen trees were below my knees, and they weren't able to grow above the browser's reach, which is the elk in this case. Now after wolves, there's many aspen that are above my head.
And not only do wolves reduce elk population size, but they also affect elk behavior, says Ripple. This is known as the ecology of fear.
The prey, the elk in this case, become fearful of their predator, so they change their behavior in such a way that we think the results ripple through the ecosystem. So there's two forces at play: the direct mortality from the predator, affecting densities of the prey, and this ecology of fear that we think affects the behavior of the prey. So, for example, the elk just don't stand around on streamside areas and munch on the plants all day long like they used to. They're more on the move and hiding out in deeper forests and going into the uplands. So the streamside areas are recovering. You know, wolves are controversial animals, and they're tough to live with. There's competition between big game hunters and wolves. It's very obvious.
That's where we are. We have some cultural and ecological conflicts set up. That's been a formula that's been in place a long time, and that's fine. But then when we get that ecological conflict, for example, back to this topic of the Pando clone. So we have this very large clone, and now in the last couple of years, we have the mature trees dying off very quickly. The insect and disease experts that went out on the ground when I went out there about a month ago, and incidentally, this is adjacent to the Fish Lake on the Fish Lake National Forest. So there's a lot of visitors in the area. There's a campground that's within this Pando clone. There's dying trees, and big dying trees next to campgrounds is dangerous, for one thing. But also, you have a lot of public around there, and so the public is very leery of active management. I mean, cutting things down, putting fences up, doing stuff like that. They don't like to see that. They want to see things in a natural state. Well, at this point, the natural state is taking over and killing a lot of old trees and perhaps killing a large part of this Pando clone. So that's part one. We always have to go back to what's happening with the birth part of the formula. We have death, and so what's happening with birth? And so in the Pando clone, the real threat to that area is browsing. We feel that this is near crisis state here, in terms of what are we going to do about that. Are we losing the largest living organism on Earth? My colleague Karen Mock likes to say that's just the one that was discovered. It's on a road. There's a lot of people there. Somebody found this about 20 or 30 years ago. Perhaps we're losing nothing, but as far as we know, this is the largest living organism on Earth. There may be others, but we are not aware of them at this time. So that in and of itself would be a great loss, I think, for the state of Utah and for science as well, because we're learning a lot about how aspen clones function over time from that particular one, because we're starting to study it more. In particular to learning about aspen, the loss of this clone could be the loss of something that's thousands of years old. So this signals, in my judgment, a failure not of an organism on Earth, but a failure of our human interactions with an organism. How do we handle and manage these things?
And ecologists stress the importance of land management, which offsets a perhaps idealistic notion that nature will take care of itself. Ron Rael, the plant ecophysiologist from Utah State University, also stresses the need to continually manage environments once they've been altered by humans.
There's a lot of natural landscapes, and we try to pretend that humans haven't had input on those, but they have, and in many cases. So in Europe, it's much more acknowledged. But they still run into the problem when human abilities to manage those landscapes don't add up anymore. The economics aren't there, the social systems perhaps aren't there. And now what do? You stop using the landscape, or you change how you use it. Well, the system's perhaps not going to maintain stability. It's not going to persist, or it's not going to have sustainability. And these become real problems. And so when you have a system that humans have been heavily involved in, it's a real challenge, because what do you do now when your activities change and nature isn't just going to heal itself overnight?
Rael is seeing another example of this problem in his research in a much different ecosystem, the cork oak forest in central Portugal. About half the world's cork comes from these forests.
If the wine industry really shifts to screw off lids or plastic corks, it could really affect the cork industry, which again will affect these ecosystems, because the management of these systems won't, you know, really pay for itself. And so this landscape that's sort of part of Portugal's heritage is at risk. And they really have some concerns about the loss of this community, because there's a fair number of species that are linked to these landscapes, and some of them are, you know, endangered species or species of real concern.
Ironically, one of the management strategies used to manage cork oak forests is cattle grazing. But with the shrinking market of cork bottle stoppers, cattle are no longer grazing in Rael's oak tree study area, and it is struggling to survive. The low-lying shrubs are able to thrive without the impact of grazing, and they are sapping the water and nutrients from the cork oak trees. They also increase the fire danger.
It's like getting humans out of a system doesn't make the system better. And the cork oak's a classic example. You remove humans in terms of the activities that they've done for hundreds of years, you end up with shrubs coming in, you end up then with fires, and fires completely take out your cork oak trees. And so you have a shrub community that has a high fire frequency, very different landscapes. So, you know, nothing wrong with that landscape, but it doesn't really necessarily function well for humans, and it's probably not a system that was very stable either. And, you know, we see that with cheatgrass in Utah, where cheatgrass is, you know, a fire system that has high fire return. It doesn't really provide us with a lot, and it wasn't the system that was here before. So these post-human activity systems aren't necessarily beneficial.
This is yet another instance of how once humans utilize a landscape, it does not rebound to its original state after a fallow period. An altered landscape needs continuous management, and ecologists are just as much concerned with humans and land management as they are with the natural world. In fact, there are very few environments left untouched.
Whether people, the public, wants to know it or not, wildlife is managed. We manage the numbers of wildlife, particularly large game. And so that may even call into question the term wildlife. How wild are these creatures? Nonetheless, they have some control over the numbers. It's what we do. It's how we've treated those landscapes over a number of years that signals the potential demise of this enormous and age-old creature. It tells me a lot about sort of our social function, our interaction with nature. And is it a healthy thing, the way we're interacting with nature? Almost all land managers and wildlife managers I talk to would hate to see this clone lost, the pando clone, but it's representative of a much larger landscape and issues that are going on across the West involving aspen. So we have an iconic clone that's representative of many other issues. And we, as scientists, professionals, land managers, for one thing, we'd hate to see ourselves be labeled as failures. Nobody wants to see that in their profession. But also, it would be an intrinsic loss to lose something like this on the landscape, and largely due to our human actions, or lack of actions, perhaps.
The Pando clone, emblems of the Rockies, are a symbol of a much larger problem: how to restore balance to an ecosystem turned unnatural by humans.
The longer we wait, the older these trees get. Just like humans, they have a little bit less output, let's say. And so they can't push as many sprouts up because they're losing energy. And many of them are dying. A dead tree cannot push up sprouts. You need that photosynthesis from above to fuel the engine below to be able to push up the sprouts. So the longer we wait, the more trouble we're in terms of trying to regenerate portions or all of this clone. And it really comes down to how much are we willing to invest in that.
For more information on aspen conservation,
they can go to our website. It's westernaspenalliance.org. And all of those words have hyphens between them. So western-aspen-and-then.org. So that's how you can find us and find out more about aspen.
Thanks for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.
Here comes the helicopter, second time today. Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say.
International politics will continue to dominate the news this weekend as Mexico takes to the polls Sunday to elect a new president. We recently saw an election of major significance take place in Greece, where Eurozone members watched nervously to see who would be called upon to stabilize one of the world's most dismal economies. In the United States, of course, the race between President Barack Obama and presumptive candidate Mitt Romney continues to heat up. But this weekend, it's Mexico's turn in the spotlight. They do things a little differently down here. First of all, the president serves only one six-year term and can never run for office again. It dates back to the 35-year regime of General Porfirio Diaz, who led the Mexican army in the rebellion against France in 1867. Mexican political history is rife with revolutionary uprisings, and like most everywhere, it is riddled with charges and countercharges of corruption. 6 years ago, it heated up white hot when Felipe Calderón defeated Andrés Manuel López Obrador by less than 1%. Obrador screamed "Pow!" and declared himself Mexico's legitimate president. His followers set up protest camps and shut down central Mexico City for 6 weeks. Obrador is running again this year as a candidate of the Party of the Democratic Revolution. The frontrunner in this election is Enrique Peña Nieto of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which ruled the country from 1929 until 2000. Josefina Vázquez Mota is running on the National Action Party ticket. Gabriel Cadre de la Torre of the New Alliance Party is trailing far behind. The issues? Well, you know, it really is a small world, and like in the United States, the economy is on everybody's mind. So are tax cuts for the wealthy, poverty, and putting a freeze on food, oil, and electricity prices. And then, of course, there is a matter of violence along Mexico's border with the United States and how to combat the cartels. Some, like Moda, want to maintain a hardline approach, while others, like Nieto and Obrador, want to simply curb the violence between the rival factions. The thought among some politicians here is that as more and more countries move toward legalization of marijuana, which former Mexican President Vicente Fox says is inevitable, it might be a good idea to have infrastructure in place to boost the nation's economy with a fertile and plentiful cash crop. There have been debates, and there are polls, of course, much like in the U.S., and they are, as we lead up to the election, all over the place. How will it all turn out? Beats me, but I am looking forward to watching the returns on election night. This is Ed Casilia for Utah Public Radio.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.